and she clutches to the floor, waiting till the ship rolls again to angle herself so that she can use gravity to fall into the co-pilot chair. She lands awkwardly against the armrests, but manages to drag herself into the seat and buckle in. More warning lights pulse on the blood-drenched console. I look back down the hall to see if Ragnar and Holiday are alive, only to see a trio of shells savage the room behind us. My teeth clatter in my skull, gut vibrating with the champagne flutes in the cabinet to my left. I can't do anything but hold on as Mustang tries to arrest our fall through orbit. The seat's gel webbing tightens against my ribcage. I feel the G-forces crushing me. Time seems to slow as the world beneath swells. We're through the clouds. On the sensor, I see something small zip away from our ship and collide into the one trailing. Light flares behind us. Snow and mountains and ice floes dilate till they're all I can see through the broken cockpit window. Wind howls, shatteringly cold against my face.
"Brace for impact!" Mustang shouts over it. "In five!"
We plummet toward a sheaf of ice floating in the middle of the sea. On the horizon, a bloody ribbon of red ties the twilight sky to the ragged coastline of volcanic rock. A giant man stands atop the rock, black and huge against the red light. I blink, wondering if my mind is playing tricks on me, if I'm seeing Fitchner before my death. The man's mouth is an open, dark chasm into which no light escapes.
"Darrow, tuck in!" Mustang shouts. I lower my head between my knees, wrap my arms around it. "Three, two, one." Our ship punches into the ice.
Chapter 26. The Ice. All is dark and cold as we sink into the sea. Water's rushed in through the mangled back of the ship and gurgles through the dozen gaping holes in the cockpit. We're already beneath the waves, the last air bubbling out into the darkness. The crash webbing sinked tight around my body upon impact, expanding to protect my bones. But now it's killing me, dragging me down with the ship. The water is freezing needles against my face. Sealskin protects my body, though, so I cut through the webbing with my razor, pressure building in my ears as I search frantically for Mustang. She's alive, and already working on escape. A light in her hand carves through the darkness of the flooded cockpit. Her razor's out, cutting through her webbing like I did. I push myself through the flooded cabin toward her. The back of the ship is missing. Three levels of vessel torn off and floating elsewhere in the darkness with Ragnar and Holiday inside. My neck's locked up from whiplash. I suck at the oxygen from the mask that covers my nose and mouth. Mustang and I communicate silently, using the signals of grey lurcher squads. The human instinct is to flee the crash as fast as possible, but training reminds us to count our breaths, to think clinically. There are supplies here we might need. Mustang searches in the cockpit for the standard emergency kit, while I search for my equipment bag. It's missing, along with the rest of the gear in the cargo hold that we were bringing the Obsidians to seize Asgard. Mustang joins me, carrying a plastic emergency box the size of her torso, which she pulled from a cabinet behind the pilot's chair. Taking a last breath, we leave the oxygen behind. We swim to the edge of the torn hull, where the ship ends and the ocean begins. It is an abyss. Mustang turns off her light as I tie our belts together with a length of the crash webbing I took from my seat. Designed to keep the Obsidians trapped in their icy continent, the carved creatures here are man-eaters. I've seen pictures of the things, translucent and fanged, eyes bulging, skin pale, worming with blue veins. Light and heat attract them. To swim in open water with a flashlight would draw things from the deeper levels. Even Ragnar wouldn't dare.
Unable to see farther than a hand's breadth in front of us, we push away from the yacht's corpse in the black water, fighting for every agonizing meter.
I can't see Mustang beside me. We're sluggish in the cold water, limbs burning as they claw darkness.
But my mind is locked and certain.
We will not die in this ocean. We will not drown. I repeat it over and over, hating the water. Mustang kicks my foot, disrupting our rhythm. I try to match it again. Where's the surface? There's no sun to greet us, to tell us we're near. It's wildly disorienting. Mustang kicks my leg again. Only this time I feel the ripple of the water beneath as something large and fast and cold swims in the depths below. I slash down blindly with my razor, hitting nothing. Impossible to fight back the panic. I'm swinging at the darkness of the 2 kilometers of ocean that stretches beneath me, and pumping my legs so desperately that I swim into the ice crust atop the water, almost knocking myself out. I feel Mustang's hand on my back, steadying me. The ice is dull grey skin that stretches above us. I stab my razor up into it. Hear Mustang doing the same beside me. It's too thick to push clear of. I grip her shoulder and draw a circle to signal my plan. I turn so my back is against hers. Together, nearly blind and out of oxygen, we cut a circle in the ice. I keep going until I feel the ice give slightly. It's too heavy to push up without traction, too buoyant to pull down with just our arms. So I swim to the side so Mustang can savage the cylinder we've cut with her razor, mincing the ice enough to push the emergency box through first. She follows and extends her hands to aid me. I slash blindly back down at the darkness and follow her up. We collapse, head first, onto the rock-hard surface of the ice. Wind rattles over our shaking bodies. We're on the edge of an ice shelf between a savage coastline and the beginning of a cold, black sea. The sky throbs deep metallic blue. The South Pole locked in 2 months of twilight as it transitions to winter. The mountainous coastline, dark and twisted, maybe 3 kilometers off. Ice stretching all the way, punctured by icebergs. Wreckage burns on the coast's mountains. Wind rushes in off the open water ahead of a coming storm, whipping the waves into calamity, so salt and spray hiss over the ice like sand buffeting through the desert. Water geysers into the air 50 meters closer inland as someone fires a pulse fist from underneath the ice. Numb and frozen, we rush toward Holiday as she pulls herself free, Mustang trailing behind with the emergency box. "Where is Ragnar?" I shout. Holiday looks up at me, face twisted and pale. Blood pools from her leg, a piece of shrapnel sticking through her thigh. Her sealskin has kept her from the worst of the cold, but she didn't have time to don her suit's hood or gloves. She tightens a tourniquet around her leg, looking back into the hole. "I don't know," she says. "You don't know?"
I rip my razor free and stumble for the hole. Holiday scrambles in front of me.
"Something is down there. Ragnar pulled it off me."
"I'm going down," I say.
"What?"
Holiday snaps.
"It's pitch black. You'll never find him."
"You don't know that."
"You'll die,"
she says.
"I won't let him go." "Darrow, stop."
She throws down the pulse fist and pulls Trigg's pistol from her leg holster and shoots it in front of my foot.
"Stop! What are you doing?"
I shout over the wind.
"I will shoot your leg out before I let you kill yourself. That's what you're doing if you go down there."
"You'd let him die."
"He's not my mission."
Her eyes are hard, unsentimental and clinical. So different from the way I fight. I know she'll pull the trigger to save my life. I'm about to lunge at her when Mustang flashes past to my left, too fast for me to say anything, or for Holiday to threaten her, as she dives into the hole, a razor in her right hand, and in her left, a flare blazing bright. Chapter 27 Bay of Laughter. I rush into the hole. Water laps peaceably at the edge. The ice is too thick to see Mustang beneath the surface as she swims, but the flare glows gently through the meter of dirty ice, blue and wandering toward the land. I follow it. Holiday tries to drag herself after. I shout at her to stay and get the medkit for herself. I follow Mustang's light, razor skimming over the ice, tracing the light underneath for several minutes, till, at last, the light stops. It's not enough time for her to run out of breath, but it doesn't move for 10 seconds, and then it begins to fade. Ice and water darkening as the light sinks to the sea. I have to get her out. I slam my razor into the ice, carving a chunk free. I roar as I jam my fingers into the cracks and lift it up, hurling it backward over my head to reveal water churning with pale bodies and blood. Mustang bursts to the surface, crying in pain. Ragnar's beside her, blue and still, pinned under her left arm as her right hacks at something pale in the water. I stab my razor into the ice behind me and hold on to the hilt. Mustang reaches for my hand, and I haul her out. Then we pull Ragnar out with a roar of effort. Mustang claws onto the ice, falling down with Ragnar. But she's not alone. A maggot-white creature, the size of a small man, has latched itself to her back. It's shaped like a snail in full sprint, except its back is tough. Hairy, translucent flesh mottled with dozens of shrieking little mouths, rimmed with needle teeth that gnaw into her back. It's eating her alive. A second creature, the size of a large dog, is stuck on Ragnar's back. "Get it off!" Mustang snarls, slashing wildly with her razor. "Get it off me!" The creature is stronger than it should be, and crawls back toward the hole in the ice, trying to drag her back to its home. A gunshot echoes, and the creature jerks as a slug from Holiday's bullet hits it square in the side. Black blood pulses out. The creature shrieks and slows enough for me to rush to Mustang and scalp the thing from her back with my razor. I kick it to the side, where it spasms as it dies. I cut Ragnar's beast in half, skinning it off his back, and hurl it to the side. "There's more down there, and something bigger," Mustang says, struggling to her feet. Her face tightens as she sees Ragnar. I rush to him. He's not breathing. "Watch the hole," I tell Mustang. My massive friend looks so childish there on the ice. I start CPR. He's missing his left boot. The sock's halfway off. Foot jerks against the ice as I pump his chest. Holiday stumbles to us, pupils huge from painkillers, her legs bound with res flesh from the medkit. She collapses to the ice beside Ragnar, tugs his sock back on his foot, like it matters. "Come back," I hear myself saying, spit freezing against my lips, eyelids crusty with tears I didn't even know I was shedding. "Come back! Your work isn't finished!" The howler tattoo is dark against his paling skin. The protection runes like tears on his white face. "Your people need you," I say. Holiday holds his hand, both of hers not equal to the size of the massive six-fingered paw. "Do you want them to win?" Holiday asks. "Wake up, Ragnar! Wake up!" He jerks beneath my hands, chest twitching as his heart kicks. Water bubbles out of his mouth, arms scrabbling at the ice in confusion as he coughs for air. He sucks it down, huge chest heaving as he stares up at the sky. His scarred lips curl back into a mocking smile.
"Not yet, All Mother. Not yet."
We're fucked, Holliday says, as we look over the meager supplies Mustang managed to scavenge from our vessel. We shake together in a ravine, finding momentary respite from the wind. It's not much. We huddle around the paltry heat of 2 thermal flares, after having humped it across the ice shelf as 80-kilometer winds shredded us with cold teeth. The storm darkens over the water behind us. Ragnar watches it with wary eyes as the rest of us sort through the supplies. There's a GPS transponder, several protein bars, 2 flashlights, dehydrated food, a thermal stove, and a thermal blanket large enough for one of us. We've wrapped it around Holliday since her suit's the most compromised. There's also a flare gun, a res flesh applicator, and a thumb-sized digital survival guide. She's right, Mustang says. We have to get out of here, or we're dead. Our boxes of weapons are gone. Our armor and grav boots and supplies sunken to the bottom of the sea. All that would have let the Obsidians destroy their gods. All that would have let us contact our friends in orbit. The satellites are blind. No one is watching. No one except the men who shot us from the sky. The lone blessing is that they crashed as well. We saw their fire deeper in the mountains as we stumbled across the ice shelf. But if they survived, if they have gear, they will hunt us. And all we have to protect ourselves is 4 razors, a rifle, and a pulse fist with a drained charge. Our sealskin is sliced and damaged. But dehydration will claim us long before the cold does. Black rock and ice span the horizon. Yet if we eat the ice, our core temperatures will lower and the cold will take us. We have to find real shelter. Mustang blows into her gloved hands, shivering. Last I saw of the charts in the cockpit, we're 200 kilometers from the spires. Might as well be 1,000, Holliday says gruffly. She chews her cracked bottom lip, still staring at the supplies as if they'll breed. Ragnar watches us discuss wearily. He knows this land. He knows we can't survive here. And though he will not say it, he knows that he will watch us die, one by one, and there will not be a thing he can do to stop it. Holliday will die first, then Mustang. Her sealskin is torn where the beast bit her and water leaked in. Then I will go, and he will survive. How arrogant must we have sounded, thinking we could descend and free the Obsidians in one night. Aren't nomads here? Holliday asks Ragnar. We always heard stories about Maroon's legionnaires.
They are not stories, Ragnar says. The clans seldom venture to the ice after autumn has fled. This is the season of the Eaters.
You didn't mention them, I say.
I thought we would fly past their lands. I am sorry.
What are the Eaters? Holliday says. My Antarctic anthropology ain't for shit.
Eaters of men, Ragnar says. Shamed cast-outs from the clans.
Bloody hell. Taro, there must be a way to contact your men for extraction, Mustang says, determined to find a way out.
There isn't.
Asgard's jamming array makes this whole continent static. The only tech for 1,000 kilometers is there. Unless the other ship has something.
Who are they?
Ragnar asks. Don't know. Can't be the Jackal, I say. If he knew who we were, then he would have sent his fleet after us, not just 1 Black Ops ship. It's Cassius, Mustang says. I assume he came in a disguised ship like I did. He's supposed to be on Luna. It was one of the positives of negotiating here. They get caught going behind my brother's back. It's as bad for them as for me. Worse.
How do you know which ship was ours? I ask. Mustang shrugs.
Must have sniffed out the diversion. Maybe he followed us from the hollows. I don't know. He's not stupid. He did catch you in the rain as well, going under the wall.
Or someone told him, Holliday says, eyeing Mustang darkly.
Why would I tell him when I'm on the gory damn ship? Mustang says.
Well, let's hope it's Cassius, I say. If it is, then they won't just hop on grav boots and fly to Asgard for help. Because then they'll have to explain to the Jackal why they were on Phobos to begin with.
How'd it go down, anyway? I asked.
It looked like a missile signature from the back of our ship, but we don't have missiles.
The boxes did, Ragnar said. I fired a Sarissa out the back of the cargo bay from a shoulder launcher.
You shot a missile at them while we were falling? Mustang asks incredulously.
Yes, and I attempted to gather grav boots. I failed.
I think you did just fine, Mustang says, with a sudden laugh. It infects the rest of us, even Holliday.
Ragnar doesn't understand the humor. My cheer fades quickly, though, as Holliday coughs and cinches her hood tighter. I watch the black clouds over the sea.
How long till that storm hits, Ragnar?
Perhaps 2 hours. It moves with speed.
It'll get to -60, Mustang says. We won't survive. Not with our gear like this.
The wind howls through our ravine and the bleak mountainside around us.
Then there's only one option, I say. We sack up and push across the mountains, find the downed ship. If it is Cassius in there, he'll have at least a full squad of 13th Legion Black Ops with him.
That's not a good thing, Mustang says warily. Those Greys are better trained for winter combat than we are.
Better than you, Holliday says, pulling back her sealskin so Mustang can read the 13th Legion tattoo on her neck.
Not me.
You're a dragoon? Mustang asks, unable to hide the surprise.
Was. Point is, PFR, Praetorian Field Regulations, mandate survival gear in long-range missile transport, enough to last each squad a month in any conditions. They'll have water, food, heat, and grav boots.
What if they survive the crash? Mustang says, eyeing Holliday's injured leg and our paltry weapon supply.
Then they will not survive us, Ragnar says.
And we're better off hitting them when they're still piecing themselves together, I say.
We go now, fast as we can, and we might get there before the storm lands. It's our only chance.
Ragnar and Holliday join me, the obsidian gathering the gear as the Grey checks her rifle's ammunition.
But Mustang's hesitant. There's something else she hasn't told us.
What is it? I demand.
It's Cassius,
she says slowly. I don't know for certain. What if he's not alone? What if Aja's with him?
Chapter 28 Feast. The storm falls as we climb along a rocky arm of the mountain. Soon we can see nothing beyond our party. Steel grey snow gnaws into us, blotting out the sky, the ice, the mountains inland. We duck our heads, squinting through the sealskin balaclavas. Boots scrape the ice underfoot. Wind roars loud as a waterfall. I hunch against it, putting one foot after the other, connected with Mustang and Holliday by rope in the obsidian way, so we don't lose one another in the blizzard. Ragnar scouts ahead. How he finds his way is beyond me. He returns now, loping over the rocks with ease. He signals for us to follow.
Easier said than done. Our world is small and furious,
Mountains lurk in the white, their hulking shoulders the only shelter from the wind. We scramble over bitter black rock that slices at our gloves while the wind tries to hurl us down gulches and bottomless crevasses. The exertion keeps us alive. Neither Holiday nor Mustang slow, and after more than an hour of dreadful travel, Ragnar guides us into a mountain pass, and the storm breathes. Beneath us, impaled upon a ridgeline, is the ship that shot us from the sky. I feel a pang of sympathy for her. Shark-like lines and flared starburst tail indicate she was once a long, sleek racing vessel of the famed Ganymede shipyards, painted proud and bold in crimson and silver by loving hands. Now she's a cracked, blackened corpse, impaled upside down on a stark ridgeline. Cassius, or whoever was inside, had a nasty time of it. The rear third of the ship sheaved off half a kilometer downhill from the main body. Both parts look deserted. Holiday scans the wreck with her rifle scope. No sign of life or movement outside. "Something seems off," Mustang says, crouched beside me. Her father's visage watches me from the razor on her arm.
"The wind is against us," Ragnar says. "I smell nothing."
His black eyes scan the peaks of the mountains around us, going rock to rock, looking for danger. "We can't risk getting pinned down by rifles," I say, feeling the wind pick up again behind us. "We need to close the distance fast-like. Holiday, you lay cover." Holiday digs a small trench in the snow and covers herself with the thermal blanket. We cover that with snow, so only her rifle's peeking out. Then Ragnar slips down the slope to investigate the rear half of the ship, as Mustang and I press for the main wreck. Mustang and I slink over low rocks, covered by the renewed vigor of the storm, unable to see the ship till we're within 15 meters. We close the rest of the distance on our bellies and find a jagged hole in the aft where the back half of the fuselage was shredded by Ragnar's missile. Part of me expected a camp of war colors and gulls preparing to hunt us down. Instead, the ship's an epileptic corpse, power flickering on and off. Inside, the ship is hollow and cavernous, and almost too dark to see when the lights crackle off. Something drips in the darkness as we work our way toward the middle of the craft. I smell the blood before I see it. In the passenger compartment, nearly a dozen greys lie dead, smashed into the floor above us by the rocks that speared the ship as it landed. Mustang kneels next to the body of a mangled grey to examine his clothing. "Darrow." She pulls back his collar and points to a tattoo. The digital ink still moves, even though the flesh is dead. Legio 13. So it is Cassius's escort. I manipulate the toggle on my razor, moving my thumb in the shape of the new desired design. I press down. The razor slithers in my hand, abandoning its sling blade look for a shorter, broader blade, so I can stab more easily in the cramped environs. There's no sign of any life as we move forward, let alone Cassius. Just the wind moaning through the bones of the vessel. A strange feeling of vertigo walking along the ceiling and looking up at the floor. Seats and belt buckles hanging down like intestines. The ship convulses back to life, illuminating a sea of broken data pads and dishes and gum packages underfoot. Sewage leaks from a crack in the metal wall. The ship dies again. Mustang taps my arm and points out a shattered bulkhead window to what looks like drag marks in the snow. Smeared blood black in the dim light. She signs to me. "There?" I nod.
A Razorback must have found the wreckage and begun feasting on the corpses of the diplomatic mission. I shudder, thinking of noble Cassius suffering that fate. A grisly sucking sound makes its way to us from farther on in the ship. We press forward, feeling the dread of the scene before we enter the forward passenger cabin. The Institute taught us the sound of teeth on raw meat, but still, this is a horrifying sight, even for me. Golds hang upside down from the ceiling, imprisoned in their crash webbing, legs pinned by bent paneling. Beneath them hunch five nightmares. Their fur is grim and matted, once white but now clumped with dried blood and filth. They gnaw on the bodies of the dead. Their heads are those of massive bears, but the eyes that peer through the eye sockets of those heads are black and cold with intelligence. Standing not on four legs but two, the largest of the pack turns toward us. The ship lights throb back on. Pale, muscled arms, slick with seal grease to ward off the cold, dark with blood from skinning the dead golds, move from under the bear pelts. The obsidian is taller than I am, a crooked iron blade sewn into his hand, human bones strung together with dried tendon as a breastplate. Hot breath billows from under the snout of the ursine skull he wears as a helmet, slow and measured. The deep ululation of an evil war chant blossoms from beneath his blackened teeth. They've seen our eyes, and one screams something unintelligible. The ship wheezes, and the lights go out. The first cannibal vaults toward us through the cluttered hull, the rest behind him. Shadows in the darkness. My pale razor flashes forward and hews through his iron knife, through his breastplate and clavicle, straight into his heart. I twist aside so he doesn't crash into me. His momentum takes him past me into Mustang, who sidesteps him and cuts his head clean off. His body spills to the ground past her, twitching. An audible grunt and a spear with a jagged iron end flies from one of the other cannibals. I duck under it and punch upward with my left hand, deflecting it into the ceiling, just over Mustang's head. Then the obsidian behind slams into me as I rise. As large as I am, stronger, more creature than man. Overwhelming me with the frenzy of a lost mind, he pins me to the wall and snaps at me with blackened, sharp-filed teeth. The lights of the ship flash, illuminating the sores around his mouth. My arms are pinned to my side. He bites at my nose. I turn my face just before he rips it off. Instead, his teeth sink into the meat at the base of my lower jaw. I scream in pain. Blood flows down my neck. He chomps down again, pulling at my face, eating me alive as the lights go out. His right hand tries to work a knife through the sealskin to slide it between my ribs and into my heart. The fabric holds. Then the cannibal goes slack, twitching, and his body falls to the ground, spinal cord severed by Mustang from behind. A black missile blurs past my face and slams into Mustang, knocking her off her feet. The fletching of an arrow sticks from her left shoulder. She grunts, scrambling on the ground. I lunge away from her, toward the three remaining obsidian. One's knocking another arrow, the second hefts a huge axe. The third holds a huge curved horn, which the cannibal brings through the bear helm to its mouth. Then a terrible howl comes from outside the ship. The lights go out. The darkness ripples with a fourth shape, shadowy forms lashing at one another, metal cutting flesh. And when the lights come back on, Ragnar stands, holding the head of one obsidian as he pulls his razor out of the chest of the second. The third, bow cut in half, pulls a knife, stabbing wildly at Ragnar. He hacks her arm off, so she rolls away, mad, immune to pain. He stalks after her and rips off her helmet. Beneath is a young woman, face painted white, nostrils slit open so she looks a snake. Ritual scars forming a series of bars under both eyes. She can't be more than 18. Her mouth slurs out something as she stares at the vastness of Ragnar, large even for her people. Then her wild eyes find the tattoos on his face.
Fionnach!
She rasps, not in terror, but fevered joy.
Tnakrur! Ljarfor Aesir!
She closes her eyes, and Ragnar cuts off her head.
You prime? I ask Mustang, rushing to her. She's already on her feet. The arrow sticks out from under her collarbone.
What did she say?
Mustang asks past me. Your Nagal is better than mine.
I didn't understand the dialect. It was too guttural. Ragnar knows it.
Stain son, kill me. I will rise golden.
Ragnar explains.
They eat what they find.
He nods to the golds,
but to eat the flesh of gods is to rise immortal. More will come.
Even in the storm, I ask, can their griffins fly on this?
His lips curl in disgust.
The beasts do not ride griffin. But no, they will seek refuge.
What about the other wreck? Mustang asks, pressing on. Supplies? Men?
He shakes his head. Bodies. Ship munitions.
I send Ragnar to fetch Holiday from her post. Mustang and I stay with plans to search the ship for gear. But I remain standing motionless in the cannibal's charnel house, even after Ragnar slipped out into the snow. The golds might have been enemies, but this horror makes life feel so cheap. There's a cruel irony to this place. It is terrifying and wicked. But it wouldn't exist unless gold made it exist to create fear, to create that need for that iron rule. These poor bastards were eaten by their own pet monsters. Mustang stands from examining one of the obsidian, wincing from the arrow that's still embedded in her shoulder. Are you all right? She asks, noting my silence. I gesture to the broken fingernails in one of the golds. They weren't dead when they started skinning them. Just trapped. She nods sadly and holds out her palm. Something she found on the obsidian body. 6 Institute-class rings. 2 Pluto cypress trees, a Minerva owl, a Jupiter lightning bolt, a Diana stag, and one which I pick from her palm, emblazoned with the Mars wolf head.
We should look for him, she says.
I reach up to the ceiling to examine the golds who hang upside down from their seats. Their eyes and tongues are gone, but I can see, mangled as they are, none are my old friend. We search the rest of the upside-down ship and find several small bedroom suites. In the dresser of one, Mustang finds an ornate leather box with several watches and a small pearl earring set in silver.
Cassius was here, she says.
Are those his watches?
It's my earring.
I help Mustang remove the arrow from her shoulder in Cassius's suite, away from the gore. She makes no sound as I break off the tip, push her against the wall, and jerk the arrow out by its tail end. She curls in on herself, slumping down to her heels in pain. I sit on the edge of the mattress that's fallen from the ceiling, and watch her hunch there. She doesn't like being touched when she's wounded.
Finish up, she says, standing.
I use the res gun to make a tiny patch over the hole on the front and back, just under her collarbone. It stops the bleeding and will help repair the tissue. But she'll feel the wound, and it'll slow her for days. I pull her sealskin back up over her bare shoulder. She zips the front up for herself,
before patching the wound on my jaw as well. Her breath fills the air. She comes so close I can smell the dampness of the snow that's melted in her hair. She presses the res gun to my jaw and paints a thin layer of the microorganisms onto the wound. They scramble into the pores and tighten to make a flesh-like antibacterial coating. Her hand lingers on the back of my head, fingers wrapped in the strands of my hair, like she wants to say something but doesn't have the words. Nor does she find them by the time Holiday and Ragnar return. Hearing Holiday calling my name, I squeeze Mustang's good shoulder and leave her there. Most of the ship's gear is gone. Several sets of optics missing from their cases. The armory missing entirely, scattered across the mountains as the ship came apart and the cargo hold ripped open. The rest has been torn through by obsidians or broken in the crash. All I get is static from the transponder and comm gear. Ragnar discerns that Cassius and the rest of his party, some 15 men, departed several hours before we reached the vessel. They stripped it bare of supplies. The eaters likely descended as soon as it landed. Otherwise Cassius wouldn't have left those golds behind to be eaten. Supporting this idea, Mustang finds several eater bodies nearer the cockpit, which means Cassius and his men were under attack as they left. Snows almost cover the corpses. We stack the fresher bodies outside in the snow, in case worse predators than eaters come to visit. After scavenging the ship for supplies, I have Mustang and Holiday seal us inside the galley, fusing the two entrances shut with welding torches found in the ship's maintenance closet. The weapons and cold gear might have been stripped clean, but the ship's cistern is full, the water inside not yet frozen, and the galley's pantries are stocked with food. It's passingly cozy in our shelter. The insulation traps our heat inside. The light from two amber emergency lamps bathes the room in soft orange. Holiday uses the intermittent power to cook a feast of pasta with marinara sauce and sausage over the galley's electric stoves, as Ragnar and I plot a course to the spires, and Mustang sorts through the stacks of scavenged provisions, filling military packs she found in storage. I burn my tongue as Holiday brings Ragnar and me heaping portions of pasta. I didn't realize how hungry I was. Ragnar nudges me, and I follow his eyes to watch quietly as Holiday brings Mustang a bowl too, and leaves her with a small nod. Mustang smiles to herself. The four of us sit, eating in silence, listening to our forks against the bowls, the wind shrieking outside, rivets groaning. Steel-grey snow piles against the small circular windows, but not before we see strange shapes moving through the white to drag off the corpses we set outside. "What was it like growing up here?" Mustang asks Ragnar. She sits cross-legged with her back against the wall. I lay adjacent to her, a backpack between, on one of the mattresses Ragnar dragged inside the room to line its floor, on my third serving of pasta. "It was home. I did not know anything else." "But now that you do..." He smiles gently. "It was a playground. The world beyond is vast, but so small. Men putting themselves in boxes, sitting at desks, riding in cars, ships. Here, the world is small, but without end." He loses himself in stories. Slow to share at first, now it seems he revels in knowing that we listen, that we care. He tells us of swimming in the ice floes as a boy. How he was an awkward child, too slow, bones outracing the rest of him. When he was beaten by another boy, his mother took him to the sky for his first time on her griffin. making him hold on to her from behind, teaching him it is his arms that keep him from falling, his will. She flew higher and higher, till the air was thin, and I could feel the cold in my bones. She was waiting for me to let go, to weaken, but she did not know that I tied my wrists together. That is as close to all mother death as I have ever been. His mother, Alia Volaris, the Snow Sparrow, is a legend among her people for her reverence for the gods. A daughter to a wanderer, she became a warrior of the spires and rose in prominence as she raided other clans. Such is her devotion to the gods that when she rose to power, she gave 4 of her own children to serve them, keeping only 1 for herself, Sephi. She sounds like my father, Mustang says softly. Poor sods, Holiday mutters. My ma would make me cookies and teach me how to strip down a hoverjack. And what about your father? I ask. He was a bad sort. She shrugs, but bad in a boring way. A different family in every port. Stereotypical legionnaire. I got his eyes. Trig got ma's.
I never knew my first father,
Ragnar says, meaning his birth father. Obsidian women are polygamous. They might have 7 children from 7 fathers. Those men are then bound to protect the other children of her brood.
He went to become a slave before I was born. My mother never speaks his name. I do not even know if he lives.
We can find out, Mustang says. We'd have to search the Board of Quality Control's registry. Not easy, but we can find him. What happened to him? If you want to know. He's stunned by the idea, and nods slowly.
Yes, I would like that.
Holiday watches Mustang in a very different way than she did just hours before when we were leaving Phobos, and I'm struck by how natural this feels. Our 4 worlds colliding together. We all know your father, Holiday says. But what is your ma like? She looks frigid, from what I've seen just on the HC, you know? That's my stepmother. She doesn't care for me. Just Adrius, actually. My real mother died when I was young. She was kind, mischievous, and very sad. Why? Holiday presses.
Holiday, I say.
Her mother is a subject I've never pushed. She's held her back from me. A little locked box in her soul that she never shares. Except tonight, it seems. It's all right, she says. She pulls up her legs, hugging them, and continues. When I was 6... my mother was pregnant with a little girl. The doctor said there would be complications with the birth and recommended intervening medically. But my father said that if the child was not fit to survive birth, it did not deserve life. We can fly between the stars, mold the planets, but father let my sister die in my mother's womb. The hell? Holiday mutters. Why not give her cell therapy? You got the money. Purity in the product, Mustang says. That's insane. That's my family. Mother was never the same. I'd hear her crying in the middle of the day, see her staring out the window. Then one night she went for a walk at Carrig Moor, the estate my father gave her as a wedding present. He was in Aegea working. She never came home. They found her on the rocks beneath the sea cliffs. Father said she slipped. If he was alive now, he'd still say she slipped. I don't think he could have survived thinking anything else. I'm sorry, Holiday says.
As am I.
It's why I'm here, since that's what you were wondering, Mustang says. My father was a Titan. But he was wrong. He was cruel. And if I can be something else... Her eyes meet mine. I will be.
Chapter 29 Hunters. By the time we wake, the storm has cleared. We bundle ourselves with insulation taken from the ship's walls and set out into the bleakness. Not a cloud mars the marbled blue-black sky. We head toward the sun, which stains the horizon a cooling shade of molten iron. Autumn has few days left. We head for the spires with plans of lighting fires as we go, in hopes of signaling the few Valkyrie scouts active in the area. But smoke will also bring the Eaters. We scan the mountains as we pass, wary of the cannibal tribes, and of the fact that somewhere ahead, Cassius, and maybe Aja, trudge through the snow with a troop of Special Forces operators. By midday we find evidence of their passing. Churned snow outside a rocky alcove, large enough for several dozen men. They camped there to wait out the storm. A cairn of stacked stones lies near the campsite. One of the stones has been carved with a razor and reads, Per aspera ad astra. It's Cassius's handwriting, Mustang says. Pulling off the rocks, we find the corpses of two blues and a silver. Their weaker bodies froze in the night. Even here, Cassius had the decency to bury them. We replace the rocks as Ragnar lopes ahead, following the tracks at a speed we can't match. We follow after. An hour later, man-made thunder rumbles in the distance, accompanied by the lonely shriek of distant pulse fists. Ragnar returns soon after, eyes shining with excitement.
I followed the tracks, he says.
And? Mustang asks.
It is Aja and Cassius, with a troop of Greys and three Peerless.
Aja is here, I ask.
Yes. They flee on foot through a mountain pass in the direction of Asgard. A tribe of Eaters harries them. Bodies litter the way. Dozens. They sprang an ambush and failed. More come.
How much gear do they have? Mustang asks.
No grav boots, scarab skin only. But they have packs. They left the pulse armor behind just 2 kilometers north, out of energy.
Holiday looks at the horizon and touches Trigg's pistol on her hip. Can we catch them?
They carry many supplies, water, food, injured men now too. Yes, we can overtake them.
Why are we here? Mustang interjects. It's not to hunt Aja and Cassius down. The only thing that matters is getting Ragnar to the spires. Aja killed my brother, Holiday says. Mustang's taken aback.
Trigg? The one you mentioned?
I didn't know. But still, we can't be pulled to the side by vengeance. We can't fight 2 dozen men. What if they reach Asgard before we reach the spires? Holiday asks. Then we're cooked.
Mustang's not convinced.
Can you kill Aja? I ask Ragnar.
Yes.
This is an opportunity, I say to Mustang. When else will they be so exposed? Without their legions, without the pride of gold protecting them. These are champions. Like Severo says, when you have the chance to waste your enemy, you do it. This is one time I'd agree with them, mad bastard. If we can take them off the board, the Sovereign loses 2 Furies in 1 week. And Cassius is Octavia's link to Mars and the great families here. And if we expose her negotiations with you to him, we fracture that alliance. We sever Mars from the society.
An enemy divided, Mustang says slowly. I like it.
And we owe them a debt, Ragnar says. For Lorne, Quinn, Trigg. They came here to hunt us. Now we hunt them.
The trail is unmistakable,
Corpses litter the snow. Dozens of eaters, bodies still smoking from pulse fire near a narrow mountain pass, where the obsidian sprang an ambush on the gold. They did not understand the firepower the golds could bring to bear. Huge craters pock the craggy slopes. Deeper imprints in the snow mark the passing of aurochs, huge steer-like animals with shaggy coats that the obsidian ride. The pass widens into a thin alpine forest that skins an expanse of rolling hills. Gradually the craters decrease, and we begin seeing discarded pulse fists and rifles, and several grey bodies with arrows or axes embedded in them. The obsidian dead are closer to the gold trail now, and bear razor wounds. There's dozens with missing limbs, clean decapitations. Cassius's band is running out of ammunition, and now Olympic knights are doing the work up close. Yet the wind still crackles with gunfire, kilometers ahead. We pass moaning obsidian eaters who lie dying from bullet wounds, but it's only over a wounded grey that Ragnar stops. The man's still alive, but barely. An iron axe is buried in his stomach. He wheezes up at an unfamiliar sky. Ragnar crouches over him. Recognition goes through the grey's eyes as he sees the stained, uncovered face.
"Close your eyes,"
Ragnar says, pressing the man's empty rifle back in his hands.
"Think of home."
The man closes his eyes, and with a twist, Ragnar breaks his neck and sets his head gently back on the snow. A shrill horn echoes across the mountain range.
"They call off the hunt," Ragnar says. "Immortality is not worth the price today."
We pick up our pace. Kilometers to our right, mounted eaters and aurochs skirt the edges of the woods, heading for their high mountain camps. They do not see us as we move through the pine taiga. Holiday watches the hunting party disappear behind a hill through the scope of her rifle. "They carried two golds," she says. "Didn't recognize them. They weren't dead yet." We all feel the chill. It's an hour later that we spy our quarry beneath us, in an uneven snowfield stripped with crevasses. Two arms of forest hug the snowfield. Aja and Cassius chose an exposed route instead of continuing through the treacherous forest where they lost so many greys. There's four left in the company. Three golds and a grey. They wear black scarab skin, cloaked with pelts and extra layers they stripped from the dead cannibals. They move at a breakneck pace, the rest of their party massacred in the depths of the woods. We can't tell which is Aja or Cassius, because of the masks and the similar shapes they make under the cloaks. Initially, I wanted to lie in wait and ambush them to take the tactical initiative, but I remember how the optics were missing from their boxes and assume Aja and Cassius are both wearing them. With thermal vision, they'll see us hiding under snow. Might even see us if we hide inside the bellies of dead aurochs or seals. So instead, I have Ragnar lead me on the path he found to cut them off at a pass they must travel through and block their path to draw their eyes. I'm panting beside Ragnar, coughing the cold out of aching lungs, when the party of four arrives on our chosen ground. They jog along the edge of the crevasse in improvised snowshoes, hunched against the weight of food and survival gear they drag behind them on little makeshift sleds. Textbook Legion survival skills, courtesy of the military schools of the Marian Field. All four wear black optics visors with smoky glass lenses. It's eerie as they see us. No expressions on the optics or masked faces, so it feels like they expected us to be here, waiting at the edge of the snowfield, blocking the pass out. My eyes dart back and forth between them. Cassius is easy enough to distinguish by his height, but which of the four is Aja?
I'm torn between two thick golds, each shorter than Cassius. Then I see my old Razor Master's weapon, dangling from her belt.
Aja!
I call, removing the sealskin balaclava. Cassius pulls off his mask. His hair is sweaty, face flushed. He alone carries a pulse fist, but I know its charge must be running low, based on the dispersion patterns of the dead cannibals behind them. His razor unfurls, as do the rest. They look like long red tongues, blood frozen on the blades.
Taro,
Cassius mutters, stunned by the sight of us.
I saw you sink.
I swim just as well as you. Remember? I look past him. Aja, you going to let Cassius do all the talking? Finally, she steps from the other to stand by the tall knight, removing from around her waist the rope that attaches her to her makeshift sled. She doffs her scarab skin mask, revealing her dark face and bald head. Steam swirls. She scans the crevasses that thread their way through the snow, and the rocks and trees, the pen and the snowfield, wondering where my ambush will come from. She remembers Europa well enough, but she can't know who my crew was, or how many survived.
An abomination and a rabid dog,
she purrs, eyes lingering on Ragnar before coming back to me. The scarab skin she wears is unmarked. Can she really not have taken a single wound from the obsidian?
I see your carver has pieced you back together, Rusta.
Well enough to kill your sister, I say in reply, unable to keep the poison out of my voice. Pity it wasn't you. She makes no reply. How many times have I seen her kill Quinn in memory? How many times have I seen her rob Lorne of his razor as he lay dead from the jackal and Lilith's blades? I gesture to the weapon. That doesn't belong to you.
You are born to serve, not speak, abomination. Do not address me.
She glances up to the sky where Phobos glitters on the eastern horizon. Red and white lights flicker around it. It's a space battle, which means several has captured ships. But how many? Aja frowns and exchanges a worried look with Cassius.
I have long awaited this moment, Aja.
Ah! My father's favorite pet.
Aja examines Ragnar.
Has the stained convinced you he's tamed? I wonder if he told you how you liked to be rewarded after a fight in the Cercada. After the applause faded and he cleaned the blood from his hands, father would send him young pinks to satisfy his animal lusts. How greedy he was with them. How frightened they were of him.
Her voice is flat and bored of this eyes, of this conversation, of us. All she wants is what we have to give her, and that is a challenge. After all the obsidian bodies behind her, she still is not tired of blood.
Have you ever seen an obsidian rat?
She continues.
You'd think twice about taking off their collars, Rusta. They have appetites you can't imagine.
Ragnar steps forward, holding his razors in either hand. He unfastens the white fur he took from the eaters and lets it fall behind him. It's strange being here, surrounded by wind and snow, stripped of our armies, our navies. The only thing protecting each of our lives, little coils of metal. The hugeness of the Antarctic laughs at our size and self-importance, thinking how easily it could snuff out the heat in our little chests. But our lives mean so much more than the frail bodies that carry them.
Ragnar's step forward is a sign to Mustang and Holiday and the trees.
Aim true, Holiday.
Your father bought me, Aja, shamed me, made me his devil, a thing. The child inside fled, the hope vanished. I was Ragnar no more.
He touches his own chest.
But I am Ragnar today, tomorrow, forevermore. I am son of the Spires, brother of Sephi the Quiet, brother of Darrow of Lycos, and Severo Aubarca. I am the shield of Tinos. I follow my heart. And when yours beats no more, foul knight, I will pull it from your chest and feed it to the griffin of the...
Cassius scans the craggy rocks and stunted trees that cup the snowfield to his left. His eyes narrow when they fall upon a cluster of broken timber at the base of a rock formation. Then, without warning, he shoves Aja forward. She stumbles, and just behind her, where she stood, the head of their remaining grey explodes. Blood splatters the snow as the crack of Holiday's rifle echoes from the mountains. More bullets tear into the snow around Cassius and Aja. The Fury moves behind the third gold, using his body as cover. Two bullets slam into his scarab skin, penetrating the strong polymer. Cassius rolls on his shoulder and uses much of the last juice from his pulse fist. The hillside erupts, rocks glowing, exploding, snow vaporizing. And under that noise is the sound of a bowstring releasing. Aja hears it too. She moves fast, spinning as an arrow fired by Mustang from the woods careens toward her head. It misses by centimeters. Cassius fires on Mustang's position on the hill, shattering trees and superheating rocks. Can't tell if she's hit. Can't spare the seconds to look because Ragnar and I used the distraction to charge, vision narrowing, sling blade curving into form, closing the distance over the snow. Pulse fist glowing in his hand, Cassius turns just as I bear down on him. He fires the pulse fist. It's a weak charge that I dive beneath, hitting the ground and rolling up like a Lycos tumbler. He fires again. The pulse fist is dead, battery drained from firing on the hillside. Ragnar hurls one of his razors at Aja like a huge throwing knife. It flips end over end in the air. She does not move. It slams into her. She spins backward. For a moment, I think he's killed her. But then she turns back to us, holding the razor by the hilt in her right hand. She caught it. A dark fear sweeps through me as all of Lorne's warnings about Aja come rushing back.
Never fight a river, and never fight Aja.
The four of us smash together, turning into a clumsy mash of cracking whips and clattering blades, scrambling and twisting and bending. Our razors faster than our own eyes can track. Aja swipes diagonally at my legs as I go for hers. Ragnar and Cassius aim for each other's necks in quick, no-look thrusts. Identical strategies, all. It's so awkward we all almost kill one another in the first half-second, yet each gambit misses by a hair. We separate, stumbling backward. Humorless smiles on our faces. A bizarre kinship as we remember we all speak the same martial language. All that hateful breed of human, Dancer told me about before I was carved. The ones Lorne lived among, and despised all the while. I shatter the weird peace first, lashing forward in a tight series of thrusts at Cassius's right side, peeling him away from Aja so Ragnar can take her down singly. Behind Cassius, Mustang stirs from among the rubble, rushing across the snow, huge obsidian bow in hand, still 50 meters away. I sweep my razor whip twice at Cassius's legs, retracting it into a blade as he swings diagonally at my head. The blow rattles my arm as I catch it halfway along the razor's curve. He's stronger than I am. Faster than he was the last time we fought. And he's practiced now against the curved blade. Training with Aja, no doubt. He forces me back, I stumble, fall. Between his legs I see the Fury and the Stained tearing into each other. She stabs him through his left thigh. Another arrow whispers through the air. It slams into Cassius's back. His scarab skin holds. Off balance, he swings again in a tight set of 8 moves. I throw myself backward just as the razor hisses through the air where my head had been. I sprawl on the snow, centimeters from the edge of a huge crevasse, scrambling up as Cassius rushes me. I block another downward swing, teetering on the edge. I fall backward and push off the edge as hard as I can, so I land and clear the other side, using my agility to avoid his onslaught. Behind him, Aja spins under Ragnar's blade, slicing at his hamstrings. She's peeling him apart. Cassius pursues me, hurdling the crevasse and swinging down at me. I block the blade. It would have opened me from shoulder to opposite hip. I throw a rock at his face, gain my feet. He slams his blade down again in a feint, pivots his wrist, and swings to carve off my knees. I stumble to the side, barely dodging. He converts his razor to a whip, cracks it at my legs, and rips them out from under me. I fall. He kicks me in the chest. Wind gushes out of me. He stands on my wrist, pinning my razor down, and is about to plunge his razor into my heart, his face a mask of determination. Stop! Mustang shouts. She's 20 meters away, aiming her bow at Cassius, hand quivering from the strain of the taut string. I will put you down! No, he says. You would... The bowstring snaps. He jerks his razor up to deflect the arrow. Misses, slower than Aja. The serrated iron tip punches through the front of his throat and out the back of his neck, the feather fletching scratching the underside of his dimpled chin. There's no spray of blood, just a meaty, wet gurgle. He flops back, hitting the ground hard, gagging, hacking hideously. His feet kick as he clutches the arrow, hissing for breath, eyes inches from my own. Mustang rushes to me. I scramble to my feet, away from Cassius, and grab my razor from the snow, pointing it